for here and now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the president's impassioned speech this morning on Iraq in London. Did he win any new hearts and minds?
And a tabloid reporter gets into Buckingham Palace and almost serves the Bushes breakfast. What if he'd been a terrorist?
Also, Marianne Pearl on her late husband Danny and the Al-Qaeda terrorists who killed him.
And journalist Sarah Fritz remembers her 12-year-old son.
We feared that he was becoming very depressed. The therapist said, well, what do you want, more drugs? And 11 days later, Daniel hanged himself.
These stories and more are coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush has defended the U.S. war in Iraq in Britain today. He told an audience of academics that war must be used in some cases to thwart terrorism. He also warned against leaving Iraq too quickly, saying Iraq must be able to stand on its own democratically.
The failure of democracy in Iraq would throw its people back into misery and turn that country over to terrorists who wish to destroy us. Yet democracy will succeed in Iraq because our will is firm, our word is good, and the Iraqi people will not surrender their freedom.
Nevertheless, as many as 100,000 anti-war demonstrators are expected to turn out tomorrow for a protest march in London. The Iraqi Education Ministry Director General in Diwaniyah province, that's about 100 miles south of Baghdad, has been assassinated by gunmen. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Baghdad this latest shooting is part of an announced policy by insurgents in Iraq.
There have been statements published in papers talking about attacking anyone who cooperates with the Americans. There have been leaflets left in the capital city and elsewhere to the same effect. Certainly, we've been hearing a certain degree of concern among Iraqis who do work either for the military or in the new government provinces and offices that are being set up by the governing council.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Baghdad. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kouraya today holds talks with leaders of Palestinian groups, including Hamas. The talks will focus on a new ceasefire. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Ahmed Kouraya will meet leaders of the Palestinian militant groups in Gaza 2 days after Egyptian intelligence chief Omar Suleiman held talks with Kouraya on a new ceasefire. Suleiman said Egypt will invite militant leaders to Cairo in several weeks after the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Leaders of Hamas have said they will agree to a ceasefire if Israel guarantees to stop assassinations of Palestinian militants. Israel Radio this morning quoted senior Israeli officials that Israel will do that if the Palestinians observe the ceasefire. Amid ceasefire talks, the violence continues. A gunman today opened fire at the crossing point between Israel and Jordan, wounding 5 Ecuadorian tourists, one of them critically. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak interrupted a speech he was giving today to the Egyptian parliament. He left the podium, and officials announced the Egyptian leader had had a health crisis. They didn't elaborate, but Mubarak returned to the podium about a half hour later. As lawmakers cheered, he spoke for another 5 minutes. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 27 points at 96.51, the Nasdaq up 7 at 18.88. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Chicago teachers have ratified a new 4-year contract. The vote wards off a potential strike in the third largest school district in the country. The new deal offers teachers a 4% raise and improved health care coverage. The government says housing starts were up sharply last month, reaching their highest level in 17 years. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
The Commerce Department says housing starts rose 2.9% in October. Builders broke ground on 1.96 million units, mostly single-family homes. Starts on those alone rose 5.7% from September. By contrast, construction starts on apartments and condominiums were down 3%. As for regions of the country, builders were busiest in the West, where housing construction jumped nearly 18%. It rose nearly 5% in the South. Housing starts dropped in the Northeast, down 18%. The Midwest also saw a decline. Separately, the Mortgage Bankers Association reports demand for home loans increased last week as 30-year fixed mortgage rates dropped to their lowest levels since July. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Chinese officials are unhappy over a U.S. decision limiting Chinese clothing imports. The Bush administration is slowing the imports in an effort to help American companies. It's also a response to the $103 billion trade deficit with China. Chinese officials say the decisions against world trade rules on free trade, and Chinese officials are weighing whether to file a lawsuit. But U.S. trade officials say there are World Trade Organization rules letting them impose the quotas on Chinese imports that enter the United States. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supportingqualityhealthcare.org, a website for professionals dedicated to improving patient care, qualityhealthcare.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush continues his 3.5-day state visit to Britain. Today he spoke to a gathering of academics. He defended the war in Iraq and appealed to the British to remain resolute on rebuilding the country.
They believe their acts of terror against our coalition, against international aid workers, and against innocent Iraqis will make us recoil and retreat. In this, they are mistaken.
Charlie Sennett is the London bureau chief of the Boston Globe, and he now joins me on the line. Welcome, Charlie.
Hi.
Charlie, what did you make of the speech? Anything new in it?
Not a lot new. I thought it was a strong speech, though. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very powerful. I thought it was uniquely elegant and eloquent for Bush, and I think that was impressive for the audience here. I think if I was going to cite a weakness in the speech, I'd say that I think he missed an opportunity. I think it was a speech in which he was preaching to the converted. These were the same kind of platitudes and kind of moral assertions about the war on terror. You know, it's an American speech to a European audience, and I think there was a certain disconnect there.
Yeah, Charlie, the president, as he so often does, brought up 9/11 and then went on to say this.
The attacks that followed on Bali, Jakarta, Casablanca, Bombay, Mombasa, Najaf, Jerusalem, Riyadh, Baghdad, and Istanbul were not dreams. They're part of a global campaign by terrorist networks to intimidate and demoralize all who oppose them.
Passionately delivered, Charlie Sennett, but again, as you were suggesting, as important as all this is, maybe we've heard it before?
I think we have heard this before. I think the call to arms in the war on terror has been answered by the British public, so I think there's a certain exasperation. The more precise criticism that's coming from the British public has to do with the reasons they went to war and the exaggeration of intelligence to take both countries in the alliance to war. And the other, I think, very pointed criticism has to do with the post-war Iraq. And I think there was an opportunity there for Bush to address those more direct criticisms. And, you know, as I say, I think he missed that.
Protests today, as large as expected?
I think tomorrow will be the big day because this is when they're going to have the large demonstration in Trafalgar Square where they'll be taking the 18-foot effigy of Bush and they'll be toppling it, trying to create a kind of mimicking of the toppling of the statue of Saddam in Baghdad by U.S. forces when they took the city.
But it can seem like almost playing games against the strong rhetoric of the president, however familiar much of that rhetoric may be. We also note the Guardian poll yesterday, which showed that more than half of Britons actually welcomed President Bush's visit.
What I thought was interesting about the Guardian poll is you have a population here that is mature, that is a friend, that is an important ally, and yet still has very important and profound criticism of the Bush administration's policies in the Middle East. The Washington would be wise to listen very carefully to the questions that are being posed. So far, we haven't seen Bush answer to those.
Charlie Sennett is the London bureau chief of the Boston Globe. He joined us from London. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Well, with President Bush in London, Britain has launched the largest security operation ever to protect him. But now Buckingham Palace is investigating a major security lapse, one that allowed an undercover tabloid reporter beyond the royal gates and into the chambers of visiting President Bush and his wife, Laura. How? He applied for a job as a footman at the palace and got it. Joining us on the line from London is Reuters reporter Lindsay Griffiths. And Lindsay, London's Daily Mirror broke this story that their reporter Ryan Parry had infiltrated the Royal Palace staff. How did this happen?
It's an enormous embarrassment for the palace. You know, the British pride themselves on putting on a very good ceremony. Pomp and pageantry are something we like to think we do very well. And obviously, putting it on for the US president, we want to do it perfectly. So as we are firing off our guns and the bearskin hats are being donned, at the very same time, the palace has this huge embarrassment of looking how on earth an undercover investigative reporter gets inside the palace, managed to spend 2 months inside the walls, and was even due to serve breakfast this very morning to President Bush's retinue. So our paper this morning was full of pictures of inside the palace, the rooms in which the Bushes were due to sleep.
Pictures taken by Ryan Parry, the footman?
Yes, pictures taken by the footman himself. He spent his 2 months there in getting all ready for his big exclusive today. And while the streets of London were thick with police, inside the very palace walls there had been a massive breach.
Ryan Parry just showed up a couple of months back and filled out some papers and got himself a job?
Well, he says he had to put in a couple of references, and they were somewhat checked out. But according to his story in today's paper, this involved basically calling down to a pub and seeing, does anybody know this gentleman? Yes, indeed, he's known to them, and he seemed to get through the net, according to his story.
Interior Minister David Blunkett, the Home Secretary, said this person did not pose a risk to the president or the queen.
He's made it very clear, as has the police. The police came out this morning to strenuously say the president was never at risk, the queen was never at risk, the man has no criminal record, he was not in himself a danger. However, clearly questions must be asked, given that this is not the first royal security breach we've had. It wasn't so very long ago, if you recall. Prince William turned 21 at his birthday party. There was a self-styled comedy terrorist wearing a pink dress, a beard, an Osama bin Laden-style beard and a turban. He managed to breach security.
It should be pointed out that Ryan Parry only wasn't a danger, theoretically, to the president and the queen today because he quit his job yesterday and walked out of the place, right?
He definitely chose not to be a danger. That wasn't the point of the exercise.
Of course.
I think it was very clearly to make a point. The editor of the paper, Piers Morgan, himself said, this is right on the edge of being hilarious, laughable, if it were not so serious and so potentially dangerous.
Given this history of problems with security, any changes in the works?
Well, not at this point. I think it's too soon to say. You know, the palace has spent quite some time organizing this trip, had obviously felt that it had security, you know, absolutely watertight. You know, the White House security detail will obviously have been very, very closely informed of all their plans. And nobody, it seemed, thought to check on the background of the servants.
Lindsay Griffith is a reporter for Reuters in London. Thanks so much for joining us, Lindsay.
Welcome.
Our society, or in Saudi Arabia, is not an open society where things were not discussed in the open. We could have prevented this if we had a more open society.
It's the home of the most revered sites in the Muslim world and of a quarter of the world's oil reserves. It's the site of two recent terrorist bombings, and it produced almost all of the 9/11 terrorist hijackers. And now Saudi Arabia is facing unprecedented challenges from without and within. Shifting Sands is a new Inside Out radio documentary from Michael Goldfarb of WBUR. He joins us now on the line from London to talk about it. Michael, hello.
Hello, Robin.
Appropriate title. Can you start by giving us a sense of what it feels like in Saudi Arabia?
It's a very, I must say, a very strange place in ways that I couldn't have imagined. You arrive, and you arrive in this magnificent terminal in Riyadh, in the capital, and you go off on really up-to-the-minute highways and new cars. You think, ah, this is the first world. This won't be such a tough trip. But there's a first-world kind of topography around you, and then the mindset of people is really very, very different and very, very foreign. And often while I was traveling there, I thought to myself, this may be why there's often miscommunication between American governments and Saudi governments, in that you make assumptions about how people are because, you know, they live in a fairly modern, physically modern place. But in fact, they are a very, very different people.
One of the clues, you say you saw a gleaming city, but no one walking around in it. Tell us about that.
It's a society which is exceptionally private. Life happens behind doors, behind the family compound walls. You know, haram is a word that Americans should get to know. I mean, it means forbidden, and it's forbidden to, you know, go to the cinema. It's forbidden to hear music in public. So, you know, all these social things that you might do in other cities in the Muslim world, from Cairo to Istanbul, even in Tehran now, you can't do in Saudi Arabia. So everything is pretty much, you know, stay at home and talk. Go to visit your cousins and talk.
Well, and so who dictates these laws? In other words, who really holds the reins of power in Saudi Arabia?
This is the key question, Robin. For 200 years, the House of Saud and the descendants of Muhammad Wahhab, who set up the Wahhabi sect back in the 18th century, have worked very, very closely. And I think in the modern world, I mean, the House of Saud kind of ducks behind them and says, well, we have to do this because this is how we practice Islam here. No one is quite sure who's wagging the dog. I spoke to people who said, you can be certain that the House of Saud is still in charge. I spoke to other people who said the House of Saud is circumscribed because if they go too far in liberalizing the country, there will be people who say that they are not serving Islam properly and they will seek their overthrow.
There seems to have been a sort of crackdown on terrorist activities since the serious terrorist attacks in Riyadh, the first last May, the second 2 weeks ago. How far is that crackdown going to go?
In the weeks after the May bombings, it became clear that they did have to crack down on the Islamic militants to whom they had probably been turning a blind eye over the last few years. And among other things, they took away the collection boxes in the mosques. Now, this was an incredibly unpopular thing to do. People gave to charity. And, you know, I mean, if some of that money went to Hamas, a lot of people wouldn't have cared. If some of that money went to Al-Qaeda, I mean, some people wouldn't have cared, but there'd be more who would hope that it didn't. And by taking the collection boxes away at, you know, the suggestion of the United States, it kind of made people dislike the U.S. more, and it put the government into a difficult position. Then you had the second bombing. And I think that more than anything, most Saudis are really angry at the notion of an Islamic terrorist group, Al-Qaeda in all likelihood, actually attacking Muslims in Ramadan in Saudi Arabia, where Islam was born.
That brings the question, what are people on the street telling you? What did they tell you in your documentary?
Interestingly enough, the people I spoke to who were most open were foreign workers who I encountered in the Bata district, which is a big market, open bazaar kind of thing I'm used to from traveling in the Middle East.
So for me, it's a big change, a real cultural shock. Yeah. She was telling me about the mortawas now.
When you come here for shopping, you must cover your hair. Yeah. You will not talk with the male.
Well, I've been walking around for about an hour. I have seen no mortawa. So maybe they're on vacation.
Michael Goldfarb, thank you so much.
Robin, thank you.
Michael Goldfarb of WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit. For more information about Shifting Sands, go to our website, here-now.org. And just ahead, we'll talk with Sarah Fritz, a Here and Now contributor who often weighs in on Washington. Today, Sarah's deeply personal report about her 12-year-old son's suicide.
There's more coming up Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Sarah Fritz is a regular commentator on Here and Now. She regularly takes part in our weekly D.C. Roundtable. But today, Sarah joins us to talk about a piece she's just written about her son, Daniel. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
Sarah, this is a devastating story. You show courage and a deep concern for others in going public with it at all.
Well, thank you.
What happened to your 12-year-old son, Daniel?
On the night of October 27, 2000, he came home from a party. He was angry that he couldn't go to a sleepover, and about an hour later, we found him hanging by his neck from a belt in his bedroom. He was dead.
Did it come as a complete shock?
A complete shock. We had no indication that he was at all considering suicide, but we feared that he was becoming very depressed. And we had gotten him some counseling, but the therapist had diagnosed him as having ADHD, which is attention deficit disorder. And when we said, we think Daniel's depressed, the therapist said, well, what do you want, more drugs? And we kind of felt like he made us feel like we were asking the wrong questions. And so we walked away without challenging that. And 11 days later, Daniel hanged himself.
Wrong questions. You were asking the right question, weren't you?
We were asking the right question. And since then, in large part just to help us deal with our pain, my husband and I have done a lot of reading and a lot of talking to experts about why children kill themselves. And it seems pretty clear right now from everything we've learned that our son was misdiagnosed, that instead of being ADHD, or maybe in addition to being ADHD, he may have been also bipolar, which is what they used to call manic depressive.
And drugs that are given for ADHD can make a situation that combines with bipolar even worse.
Yes. If a child has some kind of mental illness in their family, for example, our family, we have on both sides, my husband's side and mine, we have a history of depression and alcoholism. That child can be prone or predisposed, as they say, to bipolar illness. And so the stimulants that they give children for ADHD can bring on early onset bipolar disorder.
And yet Daniel sounds like so many other kids, bright, smart, had his bad days.
Right.
What kind of a boy was he?
Oh, he was a fabulous kid. He was bright. He was handsome. He loved his friends. He was so kind to his friends. He was just a, you know, sort of your basic all-around kid who wore baggy pants and big shirts and liked to roller skate and skateboard. I think that at minimum, I think if he had even lived a couple more weeks, it would have dawned on us that the advice that we were getting from his therapist was probably wrong, and we would have taken it to him to a psychiatrist and gotten him some antidepressant. Our therapist told us that what he really needed was a kick in the pants. And this is not unusual, though. Many children are misdiagnosed. In fact, this is really the biggest problem with mental illness among children, is that they're not properly diagnosed. And the reason I wrote this story, is as a kind of cautionary tale for other parents, that to tell them if their child is diagnosed as ADHD, there's a 70% chance that there is some other emotional disorder that goes along with that.
How have you gone on, Sarah?
Well, I have been very blessed with a lot of good friends and close family members who've helped us through our pain. But it's been very difficult. Everyone in my family has been treated for depression since Daniel killed himself. I have considered suicide on a few occasions myself. And earlier this year, I was in the hospital for 3 months with a respiratory ailment, which my doctors think I was more susceptible to because of the grief that I was suffering, and I almost died.
Yes, we actually remember, Sarah, when you were so ill, and we who value you so much at Here and Now were concerned, not even realizing what had really happened and maybe caused that illness. Again, why have you decided to put this out in public? Does it help you somehow?
Oh, yes. For a very few days this week, my son is kind of alive and living in the minds and the hearts of the people who've read my story. And that, for any parent, a mourning parent, is kind of an exciting thing. But, of course, on top of that, I want to make sure that if at all possible, I can warn other parents to be a little more attentive to the situation than my husband and I were. And if we can save a few lives, that would be terrific.
Sarah, to you and your husband Jim and your daughter Mary, we send our deepest grief and respect for your courage in bringing this story out.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Fritz is Washington Bureau Chief of the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. She's a regular on our D.C. Roundtable. To read her article and link to her website, go to here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, we meet Marianne Pearl, the widow of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl.
I could kill the people who killed Danny. It takes me 2 minutes, you know, but to talk to you and talk to other people, you know, and write this book and raise my son, it takes my whole life. It takes much more courage.
And Rachel Ray, a rising star in the Food Network firmament who makes 30-minute meals instead of reservations.
Anybody can make a reservation, but when you make dinner from somebody, you know, it shows thought and real care, and even if you burn everything, you're going to come out way ahead of it.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. President Bush, speaking in London today to a deeply skeptical British public, defended the Iraq war as necessary to confront an aggressive dictator. The president's day began with a formal welcome at Buckingham Palace, where he's staying. He later spoke at London's Banqueting Hall amid a smattering of anti-war demonstrations.
The people have given us the duty to defend them. And that duty sometimes requires the violent restraint of violent men.
Major protests are set for tomorrow when he meets with Prime Minister Tony Blair. Egypt's health minister says that President Hosni Mubarak was suffering from a cold and a slight dip in blood pressure when Mubarak fell ill during a nationally televised speech today. The 75-year-old Mubarak interrupted his remarks to Parliament for more than a half an hour, then resumed his remarks. Officials say Mubarak was also fasting for Ramadan, which might have worsened the effects of the cold. Video showing footage of attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq has surfaced on the Internet. It seems to be part of a recruiting campaign by militants. It shows scenes of fighting in Iraq. The scenes include blurred, shaky video of an American Humvee under machine gun fire and an Iraqi praising his brother for launching a suicide attack. The video was accessed on a website known for Muslim extremist and anti-American postings. Riveting testimony in a Virginia Beach courtroom this morning as the ex-wife of the convicted Washington, D.C. area sniper faced him for the first time since she divorced him 3 years ago. Mildred Muhammad, testifying in the sentencing phase of John Muhammad's trial, says he threatened to kill her after the couple separated. Muhammad and teenager Lee Boyd Malvo are charged with killing 10 people in a sniper shooting spree in Washington a year ago. In Malvo's trial today, a jury heard testimony from a woman whose 72-year-old father was the fifth victim of the sniper attacks. In New York this morning, the unveiling of the 8 finalists in the competition to establish a memorial to commemorate those killed in the 9/11 terror attacks. All 8 of the finalists selected from more than 5,000 proposals list the names of those who died in the attacks in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, as well as the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. A final decision is expected by the end of the year. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 27 points, the NASDAQ up 7 points. The S&P 500's up 3 points.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
When Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl was murdered, beheaded by terrorists in February 2002 in Karachi, Pakistan, his pregnant wife Marianne made a difficult decision to go on living. She would soon have her son to live for, but she also knew she had to live, to tell Danny's story, to defy the evil movement that silenced him. Her book is called A Mighty Heart. It's a heart-stopping thriller. It's also a heartbreaking love story of two journalists, Marianne, the French Buddhist, Danny, the American Jew, who traveled the world together for 4 years with his Barca lounger and mandolin in tow. Last night I spoke with Marianne Pearl before an audience at the Kennedy Library in Boston. She and Danny had moved to Karachi from Bombay in the wake of 9/11. He had scheduled one last interview the night they were to leave. Danny was following a tip about Richard Reed, the so-called shoe bomber. He was to meet Reed's elusive spiritual leader. Everyone had told him it would be safe because it was in a public restaurant. Marianne didn't attend because of her pregnancy. When that night did you know something was terribly wrong?
Very soon. I just had an impression, you know, I never, like, really trusted Karachi. It's a difficult place. It's very difficult to assess things over there. So Danny and I had this system that every 90 minutes, if we were not together, we would call each other. So I called him pretty quickly, and when I saw that the phone was not answering, I thought, you know, it's not a good sign. But, you know, like, you also in this kind of situation where you can't panic, so I try to, you know, stay calm and took a few hours before I called law enforcement people. Right.
Marianne and a friend quickly turned their apartment into central command, aided by a loyal Pakistani policeman, a probable CIA operative, and some of Danny's colleagues from the journal. They began a frantic race against time to find him, ultimately learning how tangled a web of Al-Qaeda Danny was caught in. Then the photographs of Danny in captivity began coming in.
It's the strangest moment of my life because seeing a photo of Danny coming out of the printer, and Danny had a gun on his head and a smile on his face. And that was, like, you know, exactly how I felt myself, you know, because to me it was a confirmation that him and I were in the same mind frame, which is, I think, for me right away what happened is that I recognized right away the nature of the threat. I knew it was very, a life and death situation. But I also knew that the only thing I could do was to resist. And when I saw the smile on his face, you know, I thought, you know, he's exactly doing the same thing. So I felt, you know, we were just together so much because we thought the same way. And then another photo came, and, you know, I saw again, and he's smart, because, you know, I mean, this is a man who has all these captors in front of him, and they have guns, and he's in shackles and everything, and he finds ways to communicate when, you know, he's actually silenced by these people, and he gives a finger, and another one, he does V for victory, you know. But I remember crying and laughing at the same time, because exactly that's how we all felt. And that was just the beginning of the ordeal, but that was going to be, until the end, for me and for him, the same attitude. The rest we know.
The rest we know. I mean, you've come to that now. Who do you blame for Danny's death?
It is complicated, you know, because, I mean, there's actual murderers, and then there's people who support them politically, and then there's people who support them financially, and then there's inertia. So if you go far, there's a lot of people to blame.
Do you ever, I wonder, hear me out, do you ever blame Danny? Do you ever have those moments of just, why did you have to go to that one meeting?
I never blamed Danny. I supported him completely, and I still support him completely. I have no regrets. And I think that all the values that we shared, I believe even stronger today, in a stronger way today, and I'm even more dedicated to them today. So that means we were right. So one of my prayers was that he had no regrets as well, and that he felt that I was not blaming him at any point.
What will you tell your son about his dad?
The truth. So I don't know
how. Is he? How's Adam?
He's great.
Yeah. How old is he?
He's 18 months. 17 months. He's very handsome, I think. He's a very, very happy little boy. He's very lively and very smiley and silly. And I feel very strong characters.
The murderers of Adam Pearl's father were caught and tried, but there are frustrations. Pakistani journalists accuse Danny Pearl of being a spy for Israel. The Wall Street Journal may have also endangered his life by turning over a discovered Al-Qaeda computer to the CIA, fueling rumors that Danny was an agent for the U.S. And now Marianne feels abandoned by the journal in a disagreement over the legal fees in the Pakistani trial of Danny's killers. And in the question and answer session last night, she made it clear how she feels about those killers.
After having the tragic experience you had, I was wondering, and I'm sure you read the papers, are we in a position to ever overcome Al-Qaeda?
Yes. when you do something, even in your own community, family, talking to your children, anything that goes towards education, that goes towards resisting this war of civilization, you defeat Al-Qaeda. And I think, you know, the most important thing is that people believed, you know, think that maybe dialogue is a lame answer, or, you know, they're so ruthless that how can you answer with dialogue? But it's not. It's way more courageous. I could kill the people who killed Danny. It takes me 2 minutes, you know. But to talk to you and talk to other people, you know, and write this book and raise my son takes my whole life and takes much more courage.
You mentioned those people who killed Danny. What would you want to see happen to them?
I wrote to President Musharraf and I said he should die. Omar Sheikh wasn't tried. And I was very sad when I wrote this letter. And I was so angry at him to oblige me, to compel me to write this word, those words. So I have no reason to forgive him. And forgiveness is not for me an incentive. Victory over them is. This is why I think, I'm objective in the fact that he should die, just because he should die.
Marianne Pearl, the wife of slain Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl, speaking last night at the JFK Library in Boston. Her new book is called A Mighty Heart.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
You're listening to Here and Now.
A journey of nearly 30 years has apparently ended for presidential candidate Howard Dean. The remains of his younger brother, Charlie, have been found in central Laos. Charlie Dean is believed to have been kidnapped by communist rebels in 1974. He'd been traveling in Asia, maybe as a tourist on an adventure, and maybe working for the U.S. government. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Howard Fineman of Newsweek. Welcome, Howard.
Of course.
Howard, you've spent time with Howard Dean on this subject. Now, Howard Dean's a guy who many say often seems like he's about to get emotional. This is an issue that will get him emotional, isn't it?
Well, it sure is, at least in my experience. A few months ago, I was up in Burlington, Vermont, at his headquarters interviewing him, just doing the sort of standard tell me everything about yourself interview at the start of the campaign, and we got to talking about his missing and presumed dead brother, Charlie. And I knew a lot of the details or everything that I'd been able to read, and I talked to one of his brothers and so forth. And so I probed pretty deeply on it. And at one point I said to Dean, who was kind of getting a little husky-voiced and emotional about it all, I said, he sounds like a great guy. I wished I could have met him. And at that point, Dean just started sobbing, and I mean really crying. Face turned beet red, eyes welled up with tears. Tears streamed down his face. He put his head in his hands. And, you know, I've been covering politicians for a long time, and I know an act when I see one.
Yeah.
And that was no act. And it was very touching. It was very, very touching. And Howard Dean comes across to many people as kind of a cold and reserved character. But he clearly, deeply missed his brother all these many years later.
He wears his brother's belt every day.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I have to say, you know, I'm a political reporter, so I've got to be careful. And I think the Dean people, as his handlers, need to be careful also. The last thing he wants to do is market his grief. But I do think it's real, and I do think that his brother was an inspiration to him, because my sense of the brother, Charlie, one of the four brothers of the Dean family, was that he was the starry-eyed idealist. He was the one who wanted to make the world better. And I think it's more than interesting that his older brother, who in many ways looked up to Charlie, has sort of taken up the fallen standard of using politics to achieve something, and ironically enough, end a war.
Yeah.
Really, it's really amazing. I mean, you don't write the screenwriters don't write this stuff because it's too pat, you know?
Yeah, and just why Charlie Dean and an Australian friend were deep in Laos has always been a question. His own parents have wondered whether he worked for the CIA.
That's right. And when I interviewed Howard Dean, I asked him about this, and he basically said he wouldn't rule it out, which somewhat astonished me. But I, from what little I know about the details, I tend to doubt that. It sounds to me like out of a sense of adventure and with a slightly self-destructive streak, perhaps, they were moths who flew a little too close to the flame of the war. That's my sense of it. But Howard Dean never knew. Now he'll have closure of a sort when he and his family, I think, go out to Honolulu soon to pick up the remains. But the rest of the mystery still is out there.
Howard Fineman of Newsweek magazine. Thanks so much, Howard.
You're very welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
35-year-old Rachel Ray has had a very pleasant path to success. Her Cape Cod family had a restaurant when she was growing up. She became a gourmet food buyer and started cooking classes to better sell her products in upstate New York, which led to a local news gig there, which led to a call from the Today Show, which got the attention of the Food Network, where now she's the host of not one but two shows and pretty much a goddess of the garlic press set. And Rachel Ray joins us in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I love being in Boston. So.
Well, we love you being here because you brought all this terrific food. And we should say what I left out is that you are the author of several cookbooks.
This is lucky number 6, yeah.
Right. And this one is called Rachel Ray, 30-Minute Meals, Get-Togethers. And there's a subtitle here. Fun menus for brunches, party munchies. I thought it said state dinners.
No, that's one thing I've never tried in 30 minutes. But you would be surprised what I put in there in 30 minutes. We have Thanksgiving meals in there. I have a whole section called Smalladays, and they are literally 30-minute, half-hour menus for the holidays when you don't do the whole, you know, Walton's dinner with 20 people around the table kind of thing.
Right. Date dinners.
Date dinners. Not... I'm a huge advocate for date dinners. You know, whether it's your first date or you've been married for 40 years, I think it is so way cool to have date nights at home rather than going out in the town, you know, because anybody can make a reservation. But when you make dinner from somebody, you know, it shows thought and real care. And even if you burn everything, you're going to come out way ahead of it.
Give me one tip, just something, you know, somebody who's looking for that great date dinner.
Well, you know, keep it very simple, but it has to be have a big ta-da factor. I usually suggest for somebody who never cooks to go with a salmon filet supper or a beef tenderloin supper because they're both so incredibly easy to make. And they look fancy and they taste fancy even though they're not.
Well, you know, you've attracted quite a following, too. We just had producers in here getting your autograph for eight-year-olds.
Yeah, I love it. You know, we go out to these book signings and this last week we've had as many as 2,000 people at a signing. And I literally, you know, shake the hands of four-year-olds up to 84-year-olds. The demographic that's out there watching the Food Network, it's great. Everybody's cooking. I love that.
Well, it's you, too. And do you are they lining up for your tip for defrosted, frozen, sliced strawberry lava flows?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, is it about the food? Is it about you?
You know what it's about? It's about their preparation of the food. And when I sit down at the computer and I start working on those recipes, I'm really trying to make food that will be successful for anyone and everyone that's trying to reproduce that at home. Mm-hmm. And that is gladly what I'm hearing at all of these signings. They say, oh, hi, it's great to meet you. And then they bust out right into their stories.
Like, for instance, what would somebody tell you in a book signing?
My husband is insanely in love with me again. He thinks I can cook. Or a guy will come up and be like, you know, my wife, I can't tell you. She's like so into me now because I'm making her great food. I had a man, his wife cooked for him for 40 years. She had a stroke. He cooks for her every night. And when he started, it would take him an hour to make a 30-minute meal. And now he says he's down to 28 minutes and he's going to take my show away from me. And little kids will make it. And, you know, for kids, it's a confidence builder to cook.
Well, see, we've done the thing that I think a lot of people do with the Food Network. I'm talking more about you, but you have food sitting here. So before we go, just go around a little, you know, little carousel here and just give me the tips of each of these.
Okay. Well, this is this over here is a crab dip that we make a lot at my house. And this is part of a menu called Holiday Pickies. In my family, all the women say, no, we don't want anything. We'll just pick. So we make these menus of little dishes so we feel like we're not eating a lot of food.
Yeah, because there's no calories. When
yeah, exactly. When it's just a picky,
sure.
There's no calories.
Oh, okay.
So this is a crab dip that we make, and then it's followed with lamb chops that my mom loves. And then over here, this is three of my mom's favorite toppings for crostini. I love having crostini parties.
Oh, wait a minute. Crostini?
Little garlic toast.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, little toast that you put out with or without garlic. I shove some garlic on mine, like bruschetta. Anyway, you make a big basket of little toast, and then we make a lot of little spreads to go on top. That over there is an Italian tuna spread that I love. It's a black olive and Italian tuna tapenade. Mm-hmm. I could eat vats of that. In fact, I did right before I came on air.
So suddenly this goes from being tuna like you'd make for your kids' lunch to a tapenade.
Kids would eat that too, though. They would never know what's in there. I mean, they wouldn't eat it if they knew it was in there probably because it's Italian tuna and anchovies, actually.
That's it?
No, it's got red onions and parsley and lemon juice and black olives, and you mix it all up in the food processor and it becomes this great tuna spread. And then this one here is just ricotta cheese and olives mixed together. That's a ricotta cheese spread. And then this one is a garlic hummus with rosemary and crushed pepper flake. So you make all these quick little toppings right in the food processor or the blender, and you put them out alongside the garlic toast, serve some Italian meats and cheeses and a whole bunch of wines, and you could have a party for, you know, quite a few people in literally, you know, just a couple minutes.
Mm. Rachel Ray, do you ever sit down and get a moment to breathe and say to yourself, excuse me, I'm a goddess.
No.
I'm a garlic goddess. I mean, your life has changed so profoundly and so quickly.
But I live on the side of a mountain and, you know, my dog still treats me the same and my family definitely treats me the same. And I have my garbage bowl and, you know, everything that I use on the show.
The garbage bowl is where
the garbage bowl is the number one tip of all time. Keep a big bowl on the counter while you're cooking. Put all your garbage in it. You make one trip to the can.
There you go.
My second greatest tip. Put a big cutting board right next to the stove so you can always chop and drop it right in the pot. Two biggest time savers ever.
Rachel Ray, who does suddenly have thousands of new friends who want to swap recipes. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Ray's latest book is 30-Minute Meals, Get-Togethers. For pictures and recipes, go to our website, here-now.org.
These days, with winter coming on, days are getting shorter just about anywhere you live in the United States. But in Barrow, Alaska, the days are about to disappear. As of today, for the next 2 months, Barrow won't see the sun at all. Joining us now from Barrow, Alaska, is Dorothy Dunbar, owner of Dorothy's Arctic Hair and Tanning Salon. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi.
Can you paint me a quick picture of what Barrow looks like?
Right now, it's about 20 below zero, and it's cold. It's total snow. The pack ice finally came in, so our ocean is packed with ice that floats in from the North Pole.
Dorothy, a tanning salon in Barrow, Alaska, around this time of year must do a land office business.
Well, I do pretty good. People tan for lots of different reasons.
So it's not necessarily the case that business picks up over the next 2 months when Barrow is dark?
It does, but there's quite a few people that tan for vacation.
So, Dorothy, Barrow's the northernmost community in North America, only 330 miles from the Arctic Circle. The sun just doesn't rise from now on at all till when?
January 23rd, we get our little horizon.
When you wake up in the morning, it's pitch black, and when you go to bed at night, it's pitch black. There's no coloration in the sky at all day?
Nope, there isn't. It's one full night.
What is that like?
For me, it wasn't bad to get used to. Some people do have problems with the no daylight. It just depends upon what your attitude is, I guess.
Yeah. I guess it flips around in the summer, though. What's it like in Barrow in the summer?
When we get our total daylight back, it's nonstop. You see activity 24 hours a day. The kids are out all night long.
Isn't that sensitive?
The city comes alive.
Is it hard for you to sleep in the summer with the sun up all the time?
No, because when it's time for bed, you put tinfoil over your windows to darken the room so you can sleep. There's quite a few people that do have a problem sleeping in the daylight, but yeah. All you have to do is just darken your windows.
Do people suffer more than in other places, do you think, from depression during this long, dark winter?
Yes, I think they do. Uh-huh. They get cabin fever, and people do come and tan for that reason, too, because they miss the daylight and they want to feel the warmth.
So you will see on the dark streets of Barrow, Alaska, in the middle of the winter, people with a lovely Floridian tan.
Well, if you look real hard, you can.
Courtesy of Dorothy's Arctic Hair and Tanning Salon. Dorothy Dunbar, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
We'll have the latest on the presidential trip to London.
And how is Mr. Bush's state visit playing on the continent? We'll talk to European editors.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.